That's Harold Shorty Baker on trumpet and Morris Lane on tenor sax, opening up on Duke Ellington's Sea Jam Blues. They're jamming with the great pianist, composer, and mentor to many jazz greats, Mary Lou Williams, in this live performance recorded at the Pythian Temple in New York City on July the 11th, 1952. If you are a New Yorker, the Pythian Temple is now a luxury condo building at 135 West 70th Street. It was where Decca Records and its studios were located. Other greats on this particular recording are Vic Dickinson on trombone, Noel John on guitar, Ed Safransky on bass, and Don LeMond on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Nutrice Lead. It is Monday, March the 23rd. And things are at a fever pitch in Chicago in the run-up to the mayoral runoff. Incumbent Mayor Rahm Emanuel, his campaign coffers fat with new money from corporate donors, had gained ground against challenger Jesus Chuy Garcia with negative ads. But Garcia has been boosted by endorsements from high-profile Democrats, prominent African-Americans who had supported Emanuel in the February 24th election, and troops and money from local and national labor unions and progressive groups. In fact, today, in New York City, a huge fundraiser is planned for Garcia, bringing together several major groups, including the City Teachers Union. We have also the UFT, the United Federation of Teachers, the Working Families Party, 1199, the Healthcare Workers Union of the Service Employees International Union, and the SEIU's Local 32BJ, MoveOn.org, and the Amalgamated Transit Union among them. They'll be hosting a major fundraiser tonight at the UFT headquarters on Broadway. That said, it is down to the wire. And in this home stretch, all eyes are now on undecided voters and African-American and Latino voters with divided political loyalties. That's where the focus is. And these groups will determine the winner, most political observers in Chicago are saying. Well, this is great. We talked before about the fact that I was a little worried about the lateness of the African-American leadership in Chicago to come forward in Chuy's camp. It seemed like a logical choice because Emanuel has been so lethal to the interests of African-Americans in Chicago. But then a listener, Henry, who calls in regularly, wrote me a pretty long, wonderful analysis, and he made the point, and it's a very good point. I didn't disagree with him on anything at all. He made the point that there had always been these tensions between African-Americans and Latinos in Chicago, and that might have been a major reason for the delay, or what seemed like a delayed reaction on the part of the African-American leadership to come forward into Chuy's camp. And he said that beyond that, Garcia himself and the campaign did not seem to be making a hefty effort to get into the communities, and that was a problem. And it may very well be true. But here's the thing. At a time like this, where the choices are so stark, you have to be able to look to leadership now to do the enlightened thing. What is the enlightened thing? People are saying, well, Rahm Emanuel did carry all of the black voting districts in the February 24th election, which means that African Americans in Chicago pretty much were favored him greatly. And of course, he in turn was favored by the guy he used to work for, Barack Obama, who came in and endorsed him and did so again this time, urging people to re-elect Rahm Emanuel. So he had a lot of heavyweight behind him politically, and it translated to a very solid vote from the African American community. We know why Chewy came late to the race, and that was working against him. He came late to the race, and it was because the presumed candidate at the time, people were hoping that she would run, and this is Karen Lewis of the Chicago Teachers Union, who successfully faced down Rahm Emanuel on the issue of educational services to the city's children, and was very successful. But not just facing down Rahm Emanuel, she was very successful at forging coalitions within the union, which had been in a tattered state before she came on. But the move that she made within the union was first to galvanize the coalition within the union, and then, of course, export that spirit to Chicago. So people were looking forward very much to her running. And if she did run, she probably would have been a very, very popular candidate. Unfortunately, about the time that it was expected she would announce, she instead announced that she was diagnosed with a brain tumor and would not run. So she declined to run. However, she approached Chewy Garcia and insisted that he run and that she would back him, which she has. So he came late to the race. It's a very critical loss of momentum. But just the same, these are just the facts. This is how things were going. You just have to deal with life the way it was. But just the same, coming late to the race, he did perform quite spectacularly. He forced, for the first time in the history of Chicago, he forced an incumbent mayor into a runoff. And that's a big deal, because the incumbent mayor has the advantage of name recognition. He has the advantage of incumbency. He's been there. He's a known entity. He's got tons and tons of money, lots of big money people pouring funds into his coffers, including Republicans, which tells you something. He's got ties to the president because he was the former chief of staff for President Obama, and Clinton, one of the more popular presidents of recent times. I have no idea why, but that's the fact. And so he had a lot of currency, a lot of political currency, and real hard cash, too. So he was well situated to just take this race. There was no need for a runoff if the political maxims held true. But even though late to the race, Chewy Garcia, who is a commissioner in Chicago, and a one-time aide, he was very, very close to Harold Washington, who really was a master at the art of coalition building, and that's how he got elected. So Chewy Garcia was definitely the underdog here in more ways than one. Cash-strapped, he started late, very low on cash, had a ragtag crew, he had to assemble his crew, and he had to do what most candidates, if they have to do it, would not succeed, which is to raise cash, build your troops, and run a campaign. It's very, very hard to do all these things at the same time. But with all of that, he forced a runoff, which is an indication of a number of things. One, great dissatisfaction with Rahm Emanuel, and it is palpable in Chicago. The dissatisfaction with Rahm Emanuel over the issue of jobs, the issue of crime, the issue of housing, and of course, the issue of education. The man has shut down already 50 schools, and as we discussed here on this program, he had at least 200 in his sights to shut down, and of course, paved the way for the charter schools to invade Chicago. So he didn't, and plus his personality is quite abrasive, he's contentious, and some people say very disdainful toward people. So he just did not, he alienated quite a few people with his attitude, plus he clearly was a man for the wealthy. So all of these things were going against him, and he just was not prepared for the upset on February the 24th. Fast forward, here we are 2 weeks before the runoff. We saw that the African-American leadership did take a long time to get its act together and decide that it had to do something. And I would say, just the same, although they're late to the game, too, in this regard, maybe there are bona fide reasons, I don't know. But it would seem to me, at a leadership level, you ought to get the big picture. The big picture here is that the people overwhelmingly are sensing that there's a need for a change in leadership in Chicago. And if you're a leader, you ought to be in tune with that sentiment. And taking as long as they did to come forward to say, well, we're going with Chewy, it could have helped him a lot if they had done that sooner. But they've done it. The question here is about coalition building. And in this regard, Chicago's race is really a test that we will be watching as to the power of coalition building. Coalition building within Chicago and outside of Chicago. Because, mind you, Chicago is a kind of template for what is going to be happening in major cities across the country, especially with large Black and Latino voting populations, because it's the urban centers, as they are called, where the concern really comes down to the fact that these two particular communities are the determinants of the outcomes of political races. We saw that, in fact, with the son of Chicago. Barack Obama was elected on the strength of the Black vote, the strength of the Latino vote as well. Of course, he got a very hefty portion of the white vote, but it was, in the end, the African-American and Latino votes that were most strategic in his victory at the polls. When we look at Chicago and we see the dynamic that we also see in cities like New York and Philadelphia and Baltimore and others, where we have these two populations, African-Americans and Latinos, comprising the element within the voting population that is most closely watched because they determine the outcomes of races. You know, like in New York, we have when we get to the 2016 races, everybody's going to be watching to see how the African American and Latino votes are going to go. And it's because of their strategic value that there's also an intense concentration on dividing the two groups. And Chicago was really like the home of this art and science of dividing the groups and pitting them against each other, rewarding one but denying the other, giving quote preferential treatment to one, denying the other. These kinds of things were used, these kinds of techniques and tactics were used to keep these two communities literally estranged from each other, competing with each other, fighting with each other, when in fact they have more in common than most people would think. But the political game is to keep them apart, to drive a wedge between them so that they are fighting each other, and the system just rides to victory right through the middle of the two. This is what I thought was happening in Chicago, where the old grievances, and there were legitimate grievances. You know, people saw, for example, let's take like Harlem, where you have Spanish Harlem and you have Central Harlem, okay? And you have the territorial attitudes about where people belonged and don't, you know, this is our turf over here and you belong over there. The notion that people were taking over the neighborhoods, the notion that they were taking jobs. And statistically, it wasn't true. I mean, statistically, it's just not holding up. But it is a sentiment that hits home so deep that it is an effective political tool. And so you have, let's say, an Ed Koch or a Rudolph Giuliani coming into power in the city of New York and played the game. The game was always to pit these particular groups against each other so that there was no chance or close to no chance of a combined effort. And this, going back to Chicago, is where you look to leadership for enlightenment, an enlightened way of doing things. To me, the challenge was to say, look, yes, we have grievances with each other and so forth, and they're longstanding, and they're not easy to overcome. However, in the moment that we are in, we are pretty clear about what our choices are. And our choices should be to unite. Our choices should be to join forces to vanquish our enemy. And there's no question that the Emmanuel administration has been very hostile to the interests and needs of these two communities. But they took a long time, and it cost momentum. And, of course, in a race this important, every second counts, especially because of the late start by the insurgent candidate, Chuy Garcia. So one hopes, in a scenario like this, you look to see whether the leadership is enlightened enough to say, all right, we have to make a hard choice, but we can make it. We can make it. Of course, the endorsements of the African-American ministers and high-profile officials and so forth, I mean, they're very good. It's a fantastic thing. It's a great positive development. The question is whether it's genuine, whether they are genuinely backing Chuy Garcia, or whether basically it was all about being symbolic and still holding in reserve the genuine acrimony that they have for whatever reason. There are a whole bunch of reasons, I'm sure. But the question is this a genuine moment here where they are working for the election of Chuy Garcia. I mentioned as we started the program that there's this major fundraising event being held in New York City today. And the purpose was made very clear, according to the report by Kenneth Lovett in the Daily News. He's quoting the head of the city teachers union is saying, "This is meant to send a message that we are fed up of the big money influence over politics, and we are fed up of the move of the so-called liberal / progressive officials away from their base, that they actually are attacking their base, or people who have historically been their base. And we're sending a message, particularly because big business has just overtaken politics, and their concerns, their interests are what run the city and the state and the country." So they're making an affirmative move on that end. Plus, they are sending troops. You see, this is the thing, ground troops. You got to get people in the street. You got to get, this is part of your political architecture. So they're committing to that as well. In this sense, coalition building is looking good from that perspective. I'm going back now to Chicago. What is the deal at ground level? Are we seeing genuine coalition building here? Are they going to really use this moment to maximum advantage to propel a desirable candidate into office and to signal to the party hacks, the people who have been using their, or I should say more correctly, abusing their offices by neglecting their base? The party has clearly moved away from its base. The Democratic Party has moved away from its base completely. And that includes, and you know I've been talking about it here, includes the president, the titular head of the party, who comes out of Chicago. You know, so Chicago is really a test not only of a new direction, a new political direction, but this test of, can we find a way to build something of a coalition effort, a coalition against big money, a coalition against the party hacks, against business as usual? Is it possible that this might be working? Jesse Jackson, one of the leading people in the endorsements from 2 weeks ago, came to power, came to very major national prominence on the basis of coalition, the Rainbow Coalition. Hello. So I'm surprised that it took so long to become involved at that level in a city that has been racked all these years by racial games played by the entrenched Democratic Party in Chicago. You pit one against the other and you drive down the middle to victory. That's the standard formula. So one hopes that this is something that we could look upon and build upon as a template, a revived coalition effort, not just in Chicago, but across the country, where people can see that they have a vested interest in unifying their efforts against this crazy system that is just, I mean, kicking us in the teeth and getting away with it. Speaking of getting away with it, we'll be dealing with that in the second half of the program today, we'll be talking about Hillary Clinton getting away with it. So let's leave it here for the moment. We shall watch this development to see how this coalition effort, both inside of Chicago and outside of Chicago, is working, whether it's going to help, and it wouldn't be too long before we know the results. It will be 2 weeks to find out just how effective it might have been. And while I'm saying this, let me be clear about winning. Winning, of course, I mean, it would be great to have somebody other than Rahm Emanuel in office in Chicago. Let's face it. However, winning is also defined by the achievement of other goals. And again, the formation of a very forceful coalition is a major, major victory. Even if Chuy Garcia doesn't get into office. In the same way that the coalition, the Rainbow Coalition, proved the validity of the idea with Jesse Jackson's runs in 1984 and 1988. It proved that people could overcome the historical barriers working together and to launch a whole new politics. And that was a major victory of his run. I think, of course, that he usurped it and used it for his own agenda. He used the power of that coalition and what it had been able to achieve. He just grabbed it and took it as his own and is now personally franchising it all over the place and doing his own thing with it. It's unfortunate because I also say that the Rainbow Coalition did not hold him accountable for that and did not publicly condemn that and criticize him for that, and serve notice that he no longer speaks for the Rainbow Coalition, and the Rainbow Coalition should have continued in its coalition-building effort. And look how much time we lost. Look how much momentum we lost. Look how much opportunity we lost to create entirely different political outcomes, because now people have to start from scratch all over again. And this is the sad part. So to a great extent, the barriers that returned to Chicago after the death of Harold Washington, because Harold Washington's election was a coalition effort, and it did foster a kind of working relationship between and among groups that had been estranged by scientific application of the Democratic Party to go to war with each other. But after Harold Washington died, so did that spirit of coalition building, it seems to me. And it would be a great thing if, with the candidacy of Jesus Chuy Garcia, there's a chance of reviving it once more. We take this break, come back and talk a little bit more right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. And, of course, today, yawn, 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 we have the first announced presidential candidate, and in the person of Ted Cruz, the junior senator from Texas, and he officially announced his candidacy today. choosing. Of course, you know, symbolism is very important. He chose to announce his candidacy at Liberty University, founded by Jerry Falwell, the largest Christian university in the world, is it's touted to be. Well, there you go. So the race is officially off, on, whatever. They're off. He's off. But the race has officially begun. And that brings me to Hillary Clinton. She, you know, I marvel at this whole thing. And I'm sure I'm not the only one, but it is a very amazing thing when you observe this. Considering that the Democrats were trounced in midterm elections last year, you would think that the party would have some kind of a plan for its comeback, and that plan would include a battalion of its best and brightest candidates to do battle to gain or regain lost turf. Well, the Republicans have spawned possible candidates aplenty. Ted Cruz, as I mentioned, being one of them, announcing today. And they have, I think, the last count, I counted about 16 to 18 Republicans who might be contesting for the nation's highest office. But the Democrats, meanwhile, seem to have sent out a memo that Hillary Clinton is to be the candidate, and everybody else better stand down. Don't even bother. Don't worry to trouble the water. We have our candidate. I wonder how this came to be. And she hasn't even announced, and people are steering clear from even hinting that they're going to run. It has been decided. And this is a marvelous characteristic of the Clintons, who I think are like the Bonnie and Clyde of politics. Hillary Clinton got into the U.S. Senate the same way. It was a done deal. Nobody else need run. You're crazy to run. We have decided. We have anointed her, and it will be a self-fulfilling prophecy because we've put everything in place to make sure she gets what she wants. And what she wants is the U.S. Senate as her first elective office. Didn't have to run for cat catcher and dog catcher and move up the ranks within the Democratic Party. That's for, you know, regular silly people. She gets to start close to the top and without competition within the party. The party saw to it. Clear the way for Hillary Clinton because she's coming to claim her office, the one with her name on it, the one that was predestined from the day she was born, and she's here to claim what is divinely hers. So get out of the way. There's nobody else who can basically bring the message to the people. Nobody else who should. It's got to be Hillary. And they had that thing locked up. Now, I want somebody to tell me with a straight face that that thing was done fair and square, that that office was won fair and square, that everybody who had an interest in running was able to compete on an equal basis, and I want somebody to tell me that with a straight face. Well, that office, having, you know, just served its time for her, the path again was cleared, absolutely cleared. She walks in and becomes Secretary of State, not qualified at all, but she becomes Secretary of State. The path was cleared. So what is it with these Clintons that they have this power to clear the path? You know, just nobody else need even contend for this job. She's got it. And she's got it because she wants it. and she wants it because it's her, you know, the next rung on the ladder toward power. And she just has to express a desire to have it, and it's hers. It didn't happen that way with Shirley Chisholm. It didn't happen that way with Carol Moseley Braun. People just walking in and saying, it's mine, I need it, I've got to have it, therefore make it happen. Now, at the same time, I'm not hearing any grumblings from anybody who finds that this is objectionable, especially women. Women, in fact, quite the opposite. They love Hillary Clinton. They think she is just the cat's pajamas. She is the epitome of womanhood and woman power and all the other woman stuff that they talk. But look at how the thing is done. They're not interested in that. It's the ends justify the means. That's it. So she ends up Secretary of State. And in that capacity, she was actually the president of the United States. She acted like she was president already. She was president of the United States while Secretary of State. And Barack Obama, she had as her prop. Remember that outrageous farewell tour? I had never seen somebody do a farewell tour because they're leaving a government job that paid very, very well, that gave you a plane to fly all over the place, pretending you're doing only the nation's business. Okay, you have the best of everything, and you don't have to spend a dime. It's all furnished for you. And she sits in her farewell tour. She's getting ready to leave office. You got to appreciate the temerity of these people. She's leaving office, which is, you know, she's a public servant. Okay? True, it was a high-profile job. It is the highest diplomatic job. But she ordered it, and she got it. It was given to her. And in that capacity, she's running around being president of the United States. Barack Obama was her backup. And she had this farewell interview running all over the country to say goodbye, like a rock star. You know, this is the farewell tour. And all along on the farewell tour, now, nobody's saying that she's campaigning, using all of this and the resources of the government and the taxpayers and everything to conduct a preliminary campaign disguised as a farewell tour, which I don't recall any Secretary of State or any public servant, for that matter, being, you know, entitled to a farewell tour. But she had one, which, of course, was, as I said, campaigning. But she was there to say goodbye to her public and to, you know, to let them know what a great job she had done. Because don't forget, in her capacity of Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton invented something that just did not exist before, and it was smart diplomacy. See, diplomacy was pretty stupid until she came along. But then she came along, and it became smart. And so the farewell tour, she's on her farewell tour. And they made a pit stop at the television studios, and there is the president. You remember how crazy I went on this program? Here's Barack Obama, the president of the United States, sitting at the end of the farewell tour next to the person who actually reports to him. But she has taken charge, and she has let the world know he reports to her. And she describes him as her buddy. The only thing Hillary Clinton didn't do was just pat him on the head, rub him. She didn't pat him on the head, but she did it in a very symbolic way. She described him as the buddy. Yeah, this is my buddy. Yeah, this is my buddy. But in the meantime, I am leaving, and I'm leaving on a high note, having done all these fantastic things for the State Department and for the country, and excelled at my job. Of course, we know the report that came out was what a mess she had the State Department in, and all the other tribulations that followed. But she wrote her and was, you know, part of the, he made a cameo appearance in his own surreal existence. Hillary Clinton says, hey, see that guy there? He's my buddy. Oh, yeah. But I'm really in charge here. I was looking forward to seeing whether she would actually have the nerve to just reach over and just pat him on the head. So Hillary did her farewell tour as senator, Secretary of State, and nobody dare interrupt the momentum. Nobody dare take away any of the thunder between the time she did her farewell tour and even now, even with the fact that the Democratic Party got its head handed to them in the last election. And you would think, well, they'll say, listen, folks, we gotta reclaim what we lost. We have to reclaim what we lost. So let's see some really good candidacies out there. But everybody is towing the Clinton line. And even with all the baggage that this woman is bringing, she expects that this entire, the party should devote its entire resources and its entire focus should be all about her. And it's working. This is a mind-boggling thing. What is it with these Clintons? What is the talent that they have that they get their way? Although, like I said, they like the Bonnie and Clyde of politics. There's so much about them that smells real bad. They have so much baggage. You know, here's a woman who is the most subpoenaed first lady in the history of the United States. No, but all these hazy, murky, slimy kinds of things associated with her and her history. But she is as clean as the driven snow and entitled to all of the oxygen in the room. And she's getting it. So the party is willing, actually, to chance disaster in 2016. Because it is waiting for Hillary Clinton to decide when she will inform her minions, you know, when Queen Hillary will inform the subjects as to when she might be inclined to declare her candidacy. And until then, everybody better stay still. Everybody better toe the line and shut up until Hillary is ready to declare her candidacy, because it is the only candidacy that matters. And the sick thing is, it will work out exactly that way. That's how sick this whole thing is. The Democratic Party is willing to take the chance, the awful chance, in the aftermath of the worst drubbing it ever had in its history in recent years, I should say, it is still willing to take the chance that it will go with Hillary. Hillary will be the one with all of the baggage that she has, and there will be nobody else to carry the banner of the Democratic Party. Personally, I couldn't care less. I think it is an interesting thing. I think the Democratic Party has become useless to most people that are looking for progress. The Democratic Party has not been able to deliver to its core constituencies. It has abandoned them. And it has abandoned them because Barack Obama has been enacting the Clinton approach to government. That secret business, you know, Hillary collecting a bunch of people in secret and hammering out with the insurance companies this thing that now is known as Obamacare. That was Hillary, who had no authority whatsoever. She was not elected to office, but she was the one making healthcare policy. All these irregularities, I mean, and nobody says within the Democratic Party, get this lady out of here. We really need to have some standards. We really need to draw the line as to what we're willing to tolerate and what we're willing to carry. But the Democratic Party is behind her. Barack Obama spent most of his term so far raising money for the presidential election of 2016. That was his job. And he took it very seriously because Hillary is not going to want to run underfunded. So you go out there, buddy, my buddy, you go out there and beat the bushes and put some millions at my disposal, which I'm also entitled to. You go out there and make that happen. And he's done it. So what is it with the Clintons? I have to ask. I don't know what it is with these people that they get exactly what they want. And nobody steps in their way. They won't tolerate it. And people understand that they won't tolerate it. So they behave ahead of even being asked. It is an amazing thing. And this woman with this horrible history is lifted up as kind of like the magic woman of the United States. She is the answer to our prayers. She is the epitome of womanhood. She is the future woman. We're looking at the future woman now. This is a woman of great accomplishment. This is a woman of just immeasurable knowledge and expertise. She is perfect in every, she's the perfect American woman. And we all need to bow down before her and give her exactly what she wants. Because, you know, she will probably have a temper tantrum. Like McCain said that the president is having over Israel a temper tantrum. Of course, it's a racist implication the way he said it, meaning, you know, having a temper tantrum like a little boy. And it's not the first time he has come to talk that way. But the Clintons are an amazing couple. The Bonnie and Clyde of politics. They are an amazing couple. And this, we're witnessing this accommodation. And it should say to people, who should really want to be in a party? It reminds me of that line by Groucho Marx. I refuse to belong to a club that would have me as a member. It's the same thing with these people. It should, anywhere they are, it should be an immediate reaction that people should just leave the room. Just leave. Because they're up to no good. Well, that brings us to the end of the program today. I want to make a small announcement. We seem to have our phones installed, and that's very good. So we will definitely be doing a lot of talking with each other. I missed it a great deal. I don't have any trouble admitting it. And I know from your letters and your notes that you miss it too. So we will be back. It's a very good sign of progress, by the way. Just to recap, the Progressive Radio Network had gone through a pretty rough period there, having to leave its offices because of it had become uninhabitable because of a pipe bursting and flooding and major damage to equipment and so forth. So there was a hurried departure from its offices. And then came a hacking job that crashed the site. And the site literally had to be rebuilt. And all of this happening at once. So people had to scramble and get things done. And we had to deal with a lot of hiccups along the way. But the main thing is that the perseverance has paid off and we are closer to permanent homes now. The studios are still being built under construction, but the essential parts of the studios, I'm told, are now in place, which are the phones. That's very, very, very wonderful news. But we have weathered the storm together, you and I, and we deserve a nice little celebration, and we'll celebrate by just ramping up the discussions that we usually have with each other. So there'll be a lot of talking to make up for time lost. So I want to thank you again for your patience. Thank you for your support. And thank you for being so loyal to PRN. It's a great, great thing. And you weathered the storm along with us. And we really thank you for that. So we look forward to talking a lot with each other. I really like that. I learn a lot. And, of course, you know, Free Your Mind Friday, of course, we have to stretch out and do some serious discussion. We missed each other quite a bit. So thank you so much for listening today. Tomorrow, Gerald Horn joins us, and we'll be talking about matters international. Ought to be a good session. It always is when Gerald is on, so I look forward to that. In the meantime, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.